welcome to episode 64 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name, as always, is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here, as always, with my gabillet friend. Oh,
goodness, what is this?
David Grigg. Yes, David. Well, how are you first?
I'm pretty well, although I'm a bit baffled by your latest description on me, but that's okay.
I have to keep looking these things up, David, and I'm getting to the end of my tether. I'm starting to struggle a bit, so I might have to give this away shortly. But this is a German word for, well, it's actually quite, it's not one of those long multi-syllabic German words, you know, how they keep on adding more and more and more syllables onto it. It's only short, sharp, and sweet. It's, eight letters, which is pretty short for a German,
very short for a German adjective.
And it's German for all things educated, cultured, cultivated, learned, literate, and refined.
Very nice.
Refined.
Refined.
That. Now, before we go on any further, today, Monday, as we're recording this, October 25, 2021, as we're recording this. Interesting date.
Right.
For one particular reason, and I will mention the start of a sentence, and then you'll be able to get this. Here it is, and I quote, "And gentlemen in England now abed."
Ah, the Henry V, Agincourt.
Yes, shall think themselves accursed they were not here.
St. Crispin's Day.
And hold their manhoods cheap whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day.
There you go. Very nice.
October 25th is St. Crispin's Day, one of the all-time great fictional speeches.
Oh, yes.
And if you get to see it done properly, it's pretty good. I much prefer the Kenneth Branagh version because I think that Laurence Olivier has a tendency, he had a tendency to make Henry V look like sort of, you know, something out of Sir Walter Scott, I think.
Yes.
And I think he just basically rolled his R's and chewed the furniture a bit too much. Mm. But Brenner's, you know, blood, guts and sweat and much, much better. And I think it works really well. But anyway, today is St. Crispin's Day.
There we go. Yeah. A little touch of Harry in the night.
Yes, and it is that... We merry men, we band of brothers.
So there's
a few little phrases that come from that particular speech.
That's the trouble with Shakespeare. It's nothing but quotes.
Yeah, well, that's the way that it works, isn't it? Yeah. Don't know how that happens. So is anything else about today that you think's important, David?
I just want to point out that this is episode 64, and if we were counting in octal, Perry, octal.
Oh, God.
Then this would be 100. This would be our 100th episode. If only we were counting an octal.
So all right. Well, I'm quite happy for that. So 64. What's that? Two to the sixth. I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, interesting number. Same number of squares on a chessboard.
Indeed.
Yes, a very interesting thing. And the what is it, the great story about how a man offered to pay his king a grain of rice or a grain of wheat, whatever it was. He put one on the first square of a chessboard and then double it for everyone afterwards to pay off his debt. And the king said, "Oh, no, it's not never going to be enough. No, I don't want that. I'll take this." And so he paid the other price, then said to him, "Well, it's a pity because if you'd taken the other one, it would have been more wheat than has ever been consumed or grown in the history of the universe." Missed that one, didn't we? Anyway. Okay, so news. There's always a bits of news floating around. We have some news on some prizes in the science fiction and fantasy genre. The first of these, which is newly announced, is the Ursula K. Le Guin Prize, a memorial prize for the writer of that name who died in 2018. Now, this award aims to honour imaginative fiction that champions hope and freedom, alternatives to conflict, and a holistic view of humanity's place in the natural world. And the new award will be open to all readers, authors, publishers, booksellers, librarians, and anywhere else can nominate work they believe fits the prize criteria. Now, there's an Ursula K. Le Guin Literary Trust, which is running this particular award. It will create a shortlist of finalists to be read by a panel of judges, including David Mitchell, Luis Alberto Urrea, and Becky Chambers. I'm not sure who Luis Alberto Urrea is, but I know who David Mitchell and Becky Chambers are. So that sounds like that will be an interesting new prize.
Yes,
although the genre is fairly replete with, yes, with prizes, will. But, you know, that's the way of it. But anyway, that one sounds interesting.
Yep.
On the Australian front, the preliminary ballot for the 2021 DITMAR Awards, otherwise known as Australian Science Fiction and Fantasy Achievement Awards, have been announced. The categories there are Best Novel, Best Novella or Novelette, Best Short Story, Best Collected Work, Best Artwork, Best Fan Publication in Any Medium, Best Fan Writer, Best New Talent, and the William Affleck Jr. Award for Criticism or Review.
Mm-hmm.
Now, voting is open to all members of the Australian NatCons between 2016 and 2021, and voting closes on November 19. These awards are normally presented at the Australian National Science Fiction Convention each year, but the one that it was where they were going to be held this year in Canberra had to be cancelled at the last minute because of a certain virus that shall remain nameless. That caused it to be not able to be held at the last minute, which was a bit unfortunate. But there we go. Another two major SF awards. Have you got any others that you know of? That
Not in the SF field, but there's the Prime Minister's Literary Awards, the shortlists of which were announced on the 22nd of October, a few days ago.
This is the Australian Prime Minister's Literary Award. We better get that right, because
the Australian Prime Minister, not Boris Johnson, Scott Morrison. Yes,
there are a few Prime Ministers around.
yes. I have no idea whether Scott Morrison has read any of these books. I may have lead to doubt it, but never mind. But the I won't go through the whole list. But the fiction category, adult fiction category, there are five people listed, or five books listed. A Treacherous Country by K.M. Krumink, don't know about that. In the Time of Foxes by Joe Lennon. Luckies by Andrew Pippos. The Bass Rock by Evie Wilde, which you've talked about on the podcast last time. The Labyrinth by Amanda Lowry, which you talked about on the podcast a few episodes ago. And then in the Young Adult Literature category, there's Loner by Georgina Young. Metal Fish Falling Snow by Kath Moore. The End of the World is Bigger Than Love, which I raved about on the podcast again some episodes ago. The F Team by Rawa Arja, and When Rain Turns to Snow by Jane Godwin. And the interesting thing is that three out of those five young adult literature books were all published by Text Publishing, as was The Labyrinth in the adult category. So, yeah, so interesting. We'll see. The winners are announced in December, so we'll see.
Yeah, there's also categories for poetry, non-fiction, children's and Australian history.
Yep.
So it covers a full range. These started 14, 15 years ago, I think 2008, somewhere around there. Don't quote me, but it was somewhere around there. All the stuff will be on Wikipedia anyway, so you can find all this thing. But hopefully we'll have some links.
We will, in the show notes, yes.
Yes. Now, there was before we get into what we were going to be discussing this week, David, I had mentioned to you that I'd come across an article which I'd read where somebody was talking about the difference between a critic and a reviewer.
Mm.
So my question to you, David, is which of those do you believe that you are, and would you be able to define a difference?
I think so. I'd say I'm definitely a reviewer and not a critic. I'm not up on literary criticism enough to really look at books in you know sort of any analytical detail. All I can do is say I read this book, I enjoyed it. These are some things I didn't enjoy it. These are some things I picked up out of it that not everyone may have picked up on, and tell people about that. So yeah, I see a critic's role as being a lot more analytical than anything I ever attempt to do. What about you?
Yeah, I think probably the same. I think that critics are there to probably try and find things in a book that you may have missed, maybe trying to put it into context or a much wider literary context. I mean, we can do that to a fair degree inside the science fiction and fantasy fields because we've read so much in those particular areas. But even there, the field's so large that, you know, there's going to be some things that we're going to miss. We're going to not necessarily see connections between one book and another. But I look at myself as purely and simply a reviewer, and I go with the idea that I try to be relatively consistent in the way I review things, and that if people can get an indication of whether they're going to like my books based on whether on what I say about them, well, that's a good thing, because that's what I do. I hunt around to try and find reviewers that I like, and if I find that they are consistently recommending books that I go on to enjoy, well, then I'll keep following them as a reviewer, because I would find their tastes aligning with mine. There's a lot that don't, and sometimes even the ones that you do think are going to be okay and align with you, they're going to come up every now and again with something which they think is fantastic, and you're going to go, well, what? Didn't like that at all. That's just the way of the world, you know, but at least it gives you a far better indication of what you think that you will probably enjoy if you follow those people. So hopefully we can provide some of that service to people who listen to this or read what it is we write.
Indeed, indeed.
That's about all we can do.
Yeah.
So, David, this week we were going to be talking about well, books that we've read recently, but there's a fair bit of non-fiction in our works today, which is a bit of a change. It's a pleasant change as well. So what have you got for us first up?
Okay, well, a kind of a book about books, I suppose.
Oh, always good.
It's called, it's non-fiction, it's called The Library, A Catalogue of Wonders by Stuart Kells. And again, another book by Text Publishing with a cover by one W.H. Chong.
Mm.
And what it is it's a compilation of information about libraries and book collectors over the centuries, and about books in general, I suppose, over the centuries. So it's full of very interesting material. The first chapter, which struck me as being a bit odd when I first encountered it, but it's actually very interesting. First chapter is an account of oral traditions of knowledge before books were invented, with a focus on the vast amount of knowledge, geographical and cultural knowledge, which comprises what sometimes is called the dreaming by Indigenous Australians and built into what's called their song lines. And it's also a look at how these stories were misinterpreted and the ideas from them misapplied by white anthropologists. So that was a very interesting chapter to start with. And then he moves into talking about ancient methods of writing, where we actually get to make marks on surfaces to put down words. You know, development of materials such as clay tablets and papyrus scrolls, and the ancient collections of writings by various rulers, and the building and demise of the great library at Alexandria. And we also then learn about the development, because up to that point everything was on scrolls. And so he talks about the development of the codex form, which is much more like what we today consider to be a bound book. So bound collections of leaves of paper or parchment or vellum. And then he moves on to talking about the medieval monks who faithfully copy and recopy volumes. And in particular, he picks on a particular monastery called St. Gall, which I think I mentioned last episode, which had a fantastic collection of documents, which they had to hide from invaders. And then of course, he moves into the development of movable type and the production of very large numbers of printed books, and how much of a difference that made to the literary world or the world of reading. And he talks about prominent bibliomaniacs, people who fill their houses with so many books they've got belly room enough to sleep. And that's certainly something which has occurred through a number of times in history. And in later chapters, we find out about the building of huge collections of books by people like English peers and or by business people like J.P. Morgan and Henry Clay Folger which were eventually converted to public institutions like the Pierpont Morgan Library and the Folger Shakespeare Library in the United States. So it's full of interesting plums, but on the downside, at times it feels like a very arbitrary collection of facts, not particularly well organized. For example, the author often skips back and forth in time just within one paragraph. You know, he might be talking about the people who steal books, or prominent people who were book thieves in the 18th century. And then in the same paragraph, he jumps to a mention of someone who made himself famous by stealing lots of books in New York in, you know, in 2007 or something like that. And then back to the 19th century, you know, within a thief there. So it's very kind of disorganized in that sort of way. I found that a bit hard to cope with. And the other thing which I really think the book could do with is an index, which I was really astonished to find that it didn't have. Sort of started to look for things and just couldn't find them again because there was no index to the book. So from my point of view, it's a book that's well worth having a look at, dipping into. You pick out an interesting piece or two here and then put it down rather than read from cover to cover. So yeah, it was okay. But as I say, it's just like this great big pile of interesting facts, not particularly well put together, I thought anyway. So that was my opinion.
Sounds interesting enough, but it sounds like something to dip into.
Oh, yes, it's well worth having a look at. Yeah, it very much to dip into, yeah.
Okay. My first one is an autobiography by British musician Richard Thompson. This is called Bee's Wing, Fairport, Folk Rock and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Now, I must admit I'm a bit of a fan of Richard Thompson, which is why I picked this up. He was a British musician who gained prominence as a guitarist with the folk rock group Fairport Convention, which he co-founded in 1967. He stayed with that for four or so years as they toured around Britain and also over to the US and into Europe. He left the group in 1971 to go solo when things started to change more than he wanted to. And he worked with his first wife, Linda, for a while, but that marriage lasted for about 10 years and then they split up. After that, he went and has remained a solo artist and has now been ranked sometime about within the last 10 years or so as the 19th greatest guitarist of all time by Rolling Stone magazine. Okay. Now, that may... you know, you may think, well, 19, that's a fair way down the track, but some damn good ones in front of him.
I'm sure.
But here's some pretty damn good ones behind him as well. And so 19th is...
Not bad.
In the history of well, modern music, because they go back to the 40s odd, I would guess, and then bring it forward through until now. So that's pretty high praise. Anyway, in this autobiography... Richard Thompson takes us from his early childhood in Highgate and Notting Hill in London, learning bits and pieces about music, and then his discovery of music and how his family were involved, the discovery of his talent that he didn't think he had first off, but then it slowly developed for him, his early playing years, the touring, a major car accident that changed his life, killed the band's drummer and Thompson's girlfriend, the final formation of Fairport Convention and with the great singer Sandy Denny, but then that fell apart and the sacking of Sandy Denny, the book carries on through to the marriage to his first wife, Linda. So it covers, as I said, the period 1967 to 1975, and he produced probably 10 or so albums, four or so probably on his own and half a dozen with Fairport Convention. So it's a fairly interesting time, 1967 to 75, because we get a bit of a look at the English folk scene, or English music scene from the folk rock side. So this is not the standard Beatles, Stones, Kinks, Who sort of stuff. This is from the folk rock side. The two parts, the pop and the folk rock, sort of intersected a bit from time to time. I mean, he mentions the fact that he was there the night that was it Syd Barrett mysteriously was left behind or not picked up for Pink Floyd, and the way that the whole of the Pink Floyd changed. He met Jimi Hendrix, he met The Who, The Beatles. He was invited to Paul McCartney's 24th birthday party, but decided no, he was too aloof to go to that. But his girlfriend went and had a great time, and so he was annoyed about the fact that he hadn't gone to that party. And so all this sort of stuff, you get these pieces of two parts of the British music scene in the late 60s, early 70s, sort of bouncing off each other and intersecting and seeing each other. And but really what you get here is what it's like to be working in a music scene that is not probably, well, not as popular as the pop music scene of the Beatles and the Stones, and what it's like to go on a hard touring grind, going living off the smell of an oily rag, driving yourself. You know, you've got one roadie and he drives the car, which is basically why that guy fell asleep and crashed it, and all this. It's a very interesting look at music in Britain in the late 60s. It's an opus and it's an honest autobiography. He acknowledges the fact he was just really immature when he was younger, and he drank far too much, smoked far too much. Didn't take much in the way of drugs because he felt that it ruined his playing, so he stayed off that. And it moves up through to his time when he converted over to the Muslim religion, and he takes that on board. But it's very much more a philosophical way of looking at it rather than solidly adherence to a radical form of the religion. It's more basically, you know, his inner religious self coming forward. Mm-hmm. And it fills in a lot of the gaps about this particular modern musician's greatest electric guitarist. I suppose you have to ask yourself when you're reading some of these things, is it a book for non-fans? Maybe not. I mean, I really enjoyed it. You don't get the deep introspection that got out of the Bruce Springsteen stuff. There's nothing vastly new here that you'd never heard before. Because in the Springsteen autobiography, he actually told everybody that he'd been suffering from severe depression for most of his life, and that there were times when he was almost suicidal. But here you don't get that, but you do get a view of this particular musician, and it really goes to show you how hard you have to work from the base level up just to get people to notice you and see where it goes. But if you persist, sometimes it works, and it works for Richard Thompson. So I give this 3.7 out of 5. As I said, it's a very interesting look at music in Britain at that time period. And if you're interested in that sort of era, well, then this is probably one for you.
Oh, interesting, interesting. There was a time in my life when I was quite fond of Steel Eye Span. You remember them?
Yeah, they were the sort of around that. But they do get mentioned in this particular book. Can't remember exactly what they say about it, but he did know. He met everybody, basically, as he was travelling around, because they were filling in, they were doing support acts for people all over the place, and so they knew everybody, basically, and everybody knew him.
All right, well, I'll move on to my book. Again, non-fiction, we're still sticking with non-fiction, and this is a book called Dead Wake by Eric Larson. Now, Eric Larson's written several very well-researched and well-written books about historical events. Probably his best-known book, which I think is really excellent, is The Devil in the White City, which is subtitled Murder, Magic and Madness at the Fair That Changed America, which was published in 2003. And that's an account of the World's Columbian Exposition, a huge trade fair, which was held in Chicago in 1893. And so he talks about the development of that, how it came to be, and how all the various things that occurred in getting that together. But running parallel to that is an even more compelling story, which is that of Dr. H.H. Holmes, who was an insane serial killer and who built a whole house devoted to his crimes. What makes Larson's book so good is the amount of detail he gives about the individual people involved in the events that he describes. Everything he talks about has a really personal human touch, which places you firmly in the time and place of the story. And these accounts are backed up by very detailed research. Anyway, on to this book, which is called Dead Wake, published in 2015. And this is about the sinking of the passenger liner Lusitania in May 1915 by a German submarine. Now, the First World War began in August 1914, and by early 1915, it had already bogged down into trench warfare. And though the German military authorities were initially sceptical of submarines, they began to use them to try to prevent munitions and supplies of food reaching Britain. And in doing this, they quickly had success sinking more and more ships. Despite this, passenger vessels were still crossing the Atlantic. Nobody believed that the Germans would sink such unarmed ships, although the German government published advertisements warning that ships of neutral nations like the USA might be targeted on suspicion that they were carrying munitions, and they mentioned the Lusitania by name. So Erik Larson draws on a huge variety of resources, such as personal letters and diaries, to give us an intimate look at the passengers who boarded the Lusitania in New York in May 1915, despite that warning from the Germans. And there are many fascinating stories about the passengers, such as the rare book dealer who was carrying a precious early manuscript of Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol to sell in London. Larson was also able to get access, which I think is quite remarkable, he was able to get access to the logbook of the German submarine, which sank the boat. This is the, I'll try to do my German pronunciation correctly here, the Unterseeboot 20, or as we would say in English, U-boat 20, which fired the fatal torpedo. And we get to know the captain of the U-20, Kapitän Leutnant Walter Swieger, as well as the captain of the Lusitania, William Thomas Turner. And Larson also takes us to the British Room 20, which was their counter-espionage office in which the British were decrypting German radio transmissions, unbeknown to the Germans, of course, including those sent by the U-20 reporting its position. And he shows us how the British were far more concerned about the safety of their dreadnought, the Orion, than that of the passenger ship, the Lusitania. He also, on the other side of the Atlantic, he takes a close look at President Woodrow Wilson of the United States, who was bitterly grieving the death of his first wife not long before the war began. And he was depressed, lonely, and desperate for affection, while at the same time being forced to deal with major world events like this war. Now, there are some similarities, of course, with the story of the Titanic, which went down just over 3 years prior to the Lusitania. But there are a number of distinct differences. For one thing, ships' radios had improved greatly over that period of time. For another, there were many more lifeboats on the Lusitania. The attack occurred in daylight hours and much closer to land, just off the southern coast of Ireland. And the water was warmer than when the Titanic went down. Given all those things, you'd expect that the sinking of the Lusitania would have led to a less tragic outcome than that of the Titanic. But unfortunately, Larson shows us why that wasn't the case. The biggest difference, of course, was that the Lusitania was sunk during wartime by an act of war. And as Larson documents, the British Admiralty was apparently doing everything it could to protect its warships like the Orion from submarine attack, while essentially letting merchant shipping fend for itself. And so we go on to the actual attack. Even though we know what's coming, Larson successfully keeps up the tension as he takes us closer and closer to the fatal moment. So the U-20, captained by Walter Swieger, had endured a long, frustrating search for targets over the previous few days, inhibited by fog, which made it very difficult for them to spot targets and made it difficult for them to spot whether they were being targeted by destroyers. Just when they were about to set back on their return trip to Germany, they spotted the Lusitania. The U-20 fired a 6-meter-long torpedo at the ship, and several of the passengers saw it coming as it raced through the water. I'm going to quote here. "The track lingered on the surface like a long, pale scar. In maritime vernacular, this trail of fading disturbance, whether from ship or torpedo, was called a dead wake, which of course is what gives us the title of the book. So then the torpedo hit, causing immense damage. Water began to pour in, and the ship almost immediately began to list or tilt to one side. And the resulting chaos and panic is very well documented by Larsen, and it's full of pathos, but I won't go into detail now. I'll spare your feelings. Though the ship had some 22 conventional lifeboats and some inflatable lifeboats, due to the fact that the ship was listing or tilting strongly to one side, only six of the lifeboats were able to be launched successfully, and only a few of the inflatable ones. The Lusitania, in fact, went down only 18 minutes after the impact of the torpedo. Now, the water, while it was much warmer than when the Titanic went down, as I said, was still cold enough to induce hypothermia in anyone in the water for any length of time, and the first rescue vessels didn't arrive for 2 hours. Almost 1,200 people died, and the event caused a storm of protest and condemnation around the world. About 170 of those who died were American citizens, and though it took another 2 long years after the sinking before America finally abandoned its neutrality and joined the Allies, the tragedy of the Lusitania was part of the reason that they eventually did. Look, it's not a cheerful subject, but the sinking of the Lusitania is a very important historical event about which I knew very little. And the way that Larsen brings the story to life and humanizes it is very well worthwhile. He certainly researched it thoroughly. The ebook version I read has got about 150 pages of notes and citations of sources, so there's heaps there that he's drawn on. So, highly recommend it, but be aware it will likely make you sad.
Yes. Not too sure I want to be sad just at the moment, but no, it sounds like an interesting book, filling in some details. Interesting that he's able to get both sides of the story.
Yeah.
That certainly makes it for a fair bit of difference to what you normally get in historical accounts of such events. You normally only get it from the side of the victors, of course, but having both sides is quite good. Interesting. All right, well, I'm going to move on to a slightly cheerier topic, although
good.
It's got a bit of pathos in this one as well, which I'll explain. The book I'm about to talk about now is A Cook's Tour in Search of the Perfect Meal from 2001 by Anthony Bourdain. Mm. Now, Anthony Bourdain, who died by his own hand in 2018, was an American celebrity chef, travel writer and documentarian. He produced a massive number of television documentaries over the period from about 2001 through until his death in 2018. And in fact, he died while he was filming an episode of his documentary series when he was in Paris at the time. Now, Bourdain first came to prominence to most people after the publication of his first book, which was called Kitchen Confidential, subtitled Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, which came out in the year 2000. That was a bit of a revelation. It was the first time that I had come across him when I read that, and that was probably 2005 or thereabouts when I read it. And it really showed the underbelly of what it was like working in a New York restaurant. The long hours, the hard work, the drinking, the drug taking, the people. But there was a lot to like about it. I mean, this guy can write. I mean, this guy can really write. This particular book, you can read it as a companion piece to the author's 2002 Food Network TV series of the same name, which was A Cook's Tour. And this is the first TV series that he actually did. Now, in a recent promo on Australian television for repeats of his last few TV series, Bourdain points out that he isn't a journalist at all. He sees things. He talks about them. He's a storyteller. That's basically what he does. And so A Cook's Tour is basically a cook's tour of stories. And this book will show you just that and how he goes about it. And here he talks about going from different parts of the world in search of different foods. And he goes to Vietnam, Portugal, Cambodia, Vietnam, France, England, and Vietnam, using his signature style you'd be familiar with if you've ever seen his work on TV. Now, if you think I keep on repeating the word Vietnam quite a lot, it's because he really, really liked Vietnam. And I can understand that because I do as well. He loves the place. And he talks about it in this particular book about possibly just giving up the rat race completely, buying a plot of land somewhere there and just living there and writing and working in the country. He loved the food, the freshness of it. He liked the people, the laid-back approach. He liked the way they dragged themselves up from the communist repression, overthrown the French, overthrown the Americans, chucked all them out, and created their own country. And he really loved it. He was hoping to be able to settle down there, but unfortunately, just wasn't to be. Now, if you like Bourdain's work as I do, you'll love this particular stuff, and it's just fantastic. And as you've quoted, I will quote you a little piece, but not about Vietnam, but because this piece I've got here is about Tokyo. I could keep on quoting from this book, vast slabs of it, but I'll only give you just a little bit of a brief taster so that you get a bit of an idea about what he's like. And he's talking about going to Tokyo. I'd only been to Tokyo once before. I knew that as soon as I hit the ground, I'd be tapping into that main vein again, a dead-bang, surefire King Hill rush. For me, Tokyo is what is like one long film trailer, one of those quick-cut, fast-moving highlight teasers for a noisy action flick with only the best parts shown. In molar, shaking, heart-pounding surround sound, the pace getting quicker and quicker, the action more frenzied, leading up to sudden blackness and the promise of more excitement to come. Mm. And he just goes on and on and on like this. I mean, he just has a fantastic style of being able to cut to the quick about what he sees and what he does. And he always gets right into the nitty-gritty of it. He doesn't go eating at the high end of town, at least not very often. He might occasionally, if he gets invited, he'll go along to have a bit of a look at it. But normally he likes to deal with street food, and he specifically likes to go and sit in people's homes and talk to people in their homes when they've cooked him a home-cooked meal. And he wants to talk to them about their food, their politics and their culture, and he wants to learn about the country based on what it is they do in their houses. And it's a very, very interesting approach. He's referred to at times as being a celebrity chef, but he's nothing like your Jamie Oliver or your Nigella Lawson or way back friend your Keith Floyds. This is a guy who basically, as he says, he's a storyteller. What he does is he goes and finds the stories and then tells you about them. And I've been following along with some of his recent documentary series on one of the streaming services. I think it's on Prime. And it's just wonderful stuff. You can just watch one episode and you think, sure, you've only got a really slice of a particular country, but that's all he can offer you in the time that he's got available. But the slice you get is as informative as a lot of other people's 10-hour series, because he gets right down to talk to the people on the street and see what they do. And he walks through the streets. Doesn't bother him if, you know, they could be in trouble. Sure, sometimes he gets to the point where the cameraman's got to turn things off because some of the local militias don't particularly like being filmed terribly much. But it's all good stuff, and I just like the way that he deals with it. Some people would find him to be pretentious. I don't. I really quite like his style, and I like this book quite a lot, and gave it a 4.5 out of 5.
Oh, very good. All right, well, I'm going to leave non-fiction behind and go on to a fiction book. And this is The Kingdoms by Natasha Pulley, and it was published in May of this year. I'd never heard of this author before, but several people, including Claire Brierley in Anzapa, recommended this novel to me, so I thought I would have a look. It sounded very intriguing, so I went ahead and got hold of a copy. So it's a very well plotted time travel alternate history story, and it's very, as I say, very cleverly put together. The book begins in the year 1898 with a man who's getting down from a train and standing on the platform looking about with some confusion. And to his horror, he realises that he's completely lost his memory. He can barely even remember his name, which is Joe Turnier. And what's more, he's puzzled by the station name being announced. It's Gare du Roi, Londres, which is in English, King's Station, London. Since when are English train stations named in French? He wonders. So he's very confused, but a kindly stranger takes him, you know, takes hold of him and takes him to a hospital where they tell him that he's had some kind of epileptic seizure, and that's why he's lost his memory. And eventually someone turns up to claim him, and he discovers that he's a household slave, married to a woman called Alice, who he doesn't recognize and who clearly doesn't appear to love him. And his master tells him that Joe has been in the master's household since Joe was a little boy. Baffled, Joe returns to his position with his master. So after spending some months in these miserable circumstances, he's astonished to receive a postcard addressed to himself at his master's address. But the post office tells him that it was lodged 100 years previously. It features a lighthouse off the coast of Scotland, and it bears the cryptic message, "Come home if you remember, M." And what's more, the lighthouse in the postcard seems vaguely familiar. Has he been there before, in the part of his life that he's forgotten? Seems highly unlikely, since it appears that he's been a bonded slave since he was a child and wouldn't have gone up to this remote location. Anyway, despite her obvious distaste for him, his wife Alice eventually falls pregnant and gives birth to a child called Lily. Alice is completely indifferent to the child, but Joe becomes besotted with her. And when Lily is a couple of years old, Joe eventually earns his freedom from his master, and he visits an engineering company which specializes in the construction of lighthouses. He shows them the postcard of the lighthouse. Yes, the manager knows of this lighthouse. It's brand new. It was built only 6 months ago. But when Joe tells him that the postcard was lodged 100 years ago, the manager just laughs and tells him that someone's pulling his leg. Anyway, he shrugs that off, and Joe eventually gets a job with the engineering company, and eventually arranges to be sent on a repair mission to this new lighthouse, whose light has now gone out. And what's more, the lighthouse keepers seem to have mysteriously disappeared. After he gets there, it takes a while before Joe, and we as the readers, discover that in the sea near to this lighthouse is a portal into the past, through which ships can blunder by accident. Without going into too much detail, Joe is kidnapped from the lighthouse by the crew of a sailing ship. And the ship's captain is a man called Missouri Kite, who has a badly scarred face. It's soon clear that Joe hasn't been snatched at random, but that Kite and his crew have come looking for him in particular. And they're from a time almost 100 years earlier than Joe's time, from the period of the Napoleonic Wars. Now, the war against France isn't going well at all for England, and Kite wants Joe to bring his modern, you know, late 19th century technical knowledge to the aid of the English side. The strange thing, though, is that Kite and his sister Agatha on board the ship show every sign of knowing Joe very well and having met him before, but they refuse to give him any details about where this has occurred. Telling him what they know, they say, will interfere with the help he can give them. So, realizing that any intervention he makes will change history, however, Joe is deeply reluctant to help. How can he bear to do something in the past which may wipe out his own timeline, and with it his beloved young daughter, Lily? So, I can't go into too much more detail. The twists and the turns of the story are very clever, and you get revelation after revelation, which I don't want to spoil. I will say, though, that the interleaved sections of the book set in closely related time periods, 1797 through 1805, can be very confusing if you don't pay close attention, because these sections largely feature the same characters, but in slightly different times. And you have to orient yourself carefully in time before you start reading each chapter. So The Kingdoms has a strong, intriguing plot, several really interesting characters who are dealing with serious moral dilemmas, often having to subvert their personal feelings in aid of larger causes, in this case, you know, trying to defeat the French. As well as Joe himself, the other main character in the book is this guy called Missouri Kite, who I think is one of the most complex characters I've encountered in science fiction. Joe and you, the reader, are never quite sure whether to think of him as a villain, a hero, an enemy, or a lover. Kite's older sister, Agatha, who raised Kite by herself, is also a really fascinating, strong female character throughout the majority of the book, and who's devoted to her brother, but only too well aware that he has deep flaws and has begun to go off the rails. Very cleverly done. Recommended. I'd like to see it on next year's Hugo ballot, but as we said with Notes from the Burning Age a couple of episodes ago, it's highly unlikely to get there, I would have thought. So, yeah, I would recommend it. It's a very good book.
I haven't heard of Natasha Pulley before.
No, me neither.
Is this her debut? Or
no, I think this is about a third book, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
There is a large number of writers out there that we aren't aware of. There's more and more coming in all the time. But it's, that sounds like a fairly intriguing
It's definitely
novel.
Intriguing. It's very well worth reading. But it's one of those books that you probably should read twice, like you know, but it's you don't have to. It's good enough to hold together without doing that. It comes to a very I won't say anymore because I'll give too much away. But it ends in a very satisfactory manner.
Oh, okay. So you can say that it ends in a satisfactory manner without giving terribly much away. That's okay. I'm also going to stay with fiction from my last book, and this is the last of the novels on this year's Hugo Award ballot for best novel. This one is Harrow the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. This is the second in the author's Locked Tomb series following Gideon the Ninth. And this book is a finalist for the 2021 Hugo Award and was also a finalist for the Locus Award for best fantasy novel. It's a bit of a toss-up as to whether some people think it's a science fiction novel or a fantasy novel. I go with it being fantasy because you'll understand as I get through this. This series, the Locked Tomb series, is set in a universe of 9 inhabited planets, each of which is ruled by a house which practices a particular type of necromancy. Mm. Therefore, there's your fantasy. The universe itself is ruled by an emperor who was immortal and worshipped as a god. Now, this emperor leads a group of powerful necromancers called lictors. And in the previous novel, Harrow, the main character of this particular book, and her cavalier, which is a sort of companion or bodyguard, Gideon, who is the main character of the previous book, travel to the emperor's home planet along with representatives of the other 8 houses. And there they are going to do battle or challenges to replace the lictors who have fallen in battle. So it's basically they're trying to move up to the level of bodyguard to the emperor. So basically they're going to become a much higher level in the hierarchy of the universe. Now, at the start of this particular novel, the second one, Gideon is dead because she died at the end of the first novel. I'm not giving anything away. And her soul is now merged with Harrow's. And having survived the events depicted previously in the first novel, Harrow is now a lictor. She made it through. And she's dedicated to protecting the emperor. She wakes up at the beginning of this particular novel on the emperor's ship and is informed about the real situation in the universe, which is far worse than she originally thought. Now, this novel is told in 2 different sections, interweaving again. One is told in the second person, depicting Harrow's experiences as a lictor, and the second told in the third person, depicting Harrow's memories of the events in the first novel, most of which seem to be at odds with what we've read previously, because there are people that were around in the first novel that don't seem to be around now. People have been replaced by other characters. People that were presumed dead are now alive, and it's all very confusing. It's mm-hmm. very, very confusing. And it would be impossible to follow without having read the first book. And even so, I was lost the vast bulk of the time while I was reading this particular book. I think it's way overwritten in a Baroque-sounding prose, so it's sort of heavy, heavy reading, and it's just a touch under 500 pages.
Mm.
It's just too long, and it's just... I know some people really, really love this because they like being confused, and they like to say, oh, I'll just keep on going over and over. I couldn't work out what was going on.
Mm.
I was just completely lost, and I'd read the first one. The first one was, well, while it was difficult to read, at least sort of had a linear flow to it. This one jumps backwards and forwards all the time without letting you know really... Sure, it's there are alternating chapters, but I don't like second-person narration. I really don't.
No.
I did a bit of reading about this, and I thought, oh, it's really grating on me, this stuff. And I did a bit of reading on it, and people are saying, oh, yeah, but it's there to actually give you, the reader, as a character in the book. I'm not a bloody character in the book. I don't want to be a character in this book. I want to be told a story about how, and show how it all comes together. I'm lost if you put me in this particular book because I don't think like this. So you can't basically assume that this is the way that I'm going to act. And it just grated the hell out of me when I got this. The other problem I found with this particular book, with a lot of previous series that you read, where you finish off the first particular book, then you come to the second one a year or so later, the author is generally of the view that they will assume that, yes, you may have read it, but it's been a while. They're not going to assume that you're going to go back and read the first one again before you read the second one. So they sort of lead you in to the second book. So you get a bit of an idea about what's going on. There's nothing like that here. You're just dropped in the deep end and off you go. And I had to go, what? Had to go back and start reading some of the stuff on Wikipedia to get the plot. That happened. Yeah, okay. And I started reading it. What? And then I had to go off and try and refine other things to try and work out what was going on. I continually kept on getting chucked out of this particular novel, and it was just incredibly difficult to read. I know that a lot of people are going to say this is some of the best things that they've read in a long, long time. She's really brave. She's done such a fantastic job. But the difficulty is that even after having read the first one, and the first in this series was this author's first novel, and this is her second novel, you've got to this point, as I've said previously, that there are times when, because it's a new writer, you don't actually trust the writer to be able to land the ending or to land the book. And I got lost more than once, many, many times. And I found it a real struggle to get through this particular book. And I certainly won't be voting for it as the best in the on the ballot, that's for sure. Mm. It's still behind Piranesi and Network Effect by Martha Wells, in my view. And I gave it a 3.1 because I think there's a lot of craft here, but I think the craft just overpowers the sense of a reading pleasure for me. Mm. I find it difficult. I think that with this whole idea of series that go on and on and on. Oh, by the way, there's two more books to come. Oh, so there's going to end up being something in the vicinity of 2,000 words here. Yeah. 2,000 pages here of this particular series. My God, that's ginormous. And I just don't think it's got enough in it to carry it. And it's attempting to make things far more complicated than they need to be. Anyway, that's just me. Mm. Maybe I'm going to get dumped on because people think it's fantastic, but I don't know. Mm. Nah, couldn't read it.
Okay.
For the dedicated, and that's it, I reckon.
So we've now, between us, read all the books, all the novels, which have been, in fact, we've read all the fiction that's been nominated for Hugo Award this year. So in terms of the novels, we haven't each read all of the novels, but how would you rank the ones you've read then?
Oh, yeah, Piranesi, from the sounds of things, the top two would be Piranesi and Network Effect. I thought both of those were pretty good. Actually, third, I'd have Black Sun, I think, because I really quite enjoyed that, and I wasn't expecting to, because the previous book of that author's that I'd read, Rebecca and Rowan Horse, I thought, wasn't all that flat, but I thought this one was excellent. It did not try to be as complicated as this, for example. I know that you weren't overly keen on the Jemison.
No, I wasn't.
And I haven't yet read the Cowl.
Relentless Moon? Yeah,
the one set on Mars. I've actually read the
second. No, set on the moon.
On the moon. Well, I've actually said I've read the second book, Fated Sky, in that series, so that I can get myself up to be able to reading that last one. And I read that recently. Yeah, and they're a pleasant book, but they don't really break much real ground, really.
I mean, you may well like the Jemison novel, but it just grated on me for all sorts of reasons. I just found it very hard to take.
I did read all three of the Jemison Broken Earth series, and I liked the first one. I thought the first one was interesting. Second one, I thought, second book in a series, and that's what it really felt like. And the third one, I thought, it's not really going, it didn't really do much for me at the end. Mm. I thought the first one was good, but the second two, nah, not quite so much. And but it won. They all won Hugo Awards. And so if I was a betting man,
yes,
David,
yes.
I'd be putting my money on Jemison.
Yeah, me
but
too.
I won't be voting for it. I'll be voting it probably below two.
Mm.
I don't know what I'll be putting it as, maybe four. Mm. But at this stage, I would say Piranesi in particular, which I thought was excellent, and then Network Effect, which I really liked. Mm. So they would be my two.
Yeah, sure. Well, for me, it would be Piranesi first, obviously, and the second would be the one on the moon. What's it called? The Relentless Moon. That would be the second one, and then very far down the list would be The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin. Look, right. I'm sure there are people. I'm sure I was probably too hard on the Jemisin novel in the last episode. I jumped into it with, you know, both boots, but it's not that bad a book. It's reasonably well written. It's entertaining. Just the premise annoyed the heck out of me.
Well, look, I'm not saying that you read these books and you don't sort of say that, yeah, these are bad books in the sense of badly written. None of these books are badly written. I mean, all these people are very, very good writers.
Yeah.
And what it comes down to then is execution and content. And so, you know, on a sentence-by-sentence basis, all these people are very, very good writers.
Yeah,
I'm not complaining about that at all. It's merely the bit at the end where you come away from and say, what was that great line about, you know, you have to be able to write a story that will basically people will spend their beer money on. Would I have spent my beer money on these in normal circumstances? Piranesi, absolutely. Network Effect, yes. The Roan Horse, yes. The others, then you start tossing up. And then it comes down to, do I like them or do I not? And that's really what it comes to. And you can only go from what it is you like and what you don't.
Sure.
And if you can give a reason for it, all the better.
Yep.
So, but I was disappointed in... I was looking forward to Harrow the Ninth because although I found Gideon the Ninth difficult, I got to the end and I enjoyed it. Didn't enjoy this one at all.
No.
Yeah.
Never mind. All right.
There we are. Well, that's about it for this episode, David, as we've coming up close to the hour.
Yes,
next episode, we go to the Hugo Time Machine for 1967.
Wow.
Yes.
Winding ourselves back.
We're winding ourselves back. Second year of the Nebulas in 1967. First year, last time, was, of course, that June won both awards, although in the Hugos it was a tie between June and the Zelazny novel and Call Me Conrad. This time we have different winners for the Hugo and for the Nebulas, at least at the novel level. And so we shall be discussing those next time. We won't get through, I don't think we'll get through all of the nominated novels.
No.
There'll be a couple that I don't quite get to, but I will hope to certainly get through the bulk of them. I've read most of the short fiction now. There's a couple of little bits that I need to pick up on, but we'll discuss it in 2 weeks.
We will.
Yep. Indeed. Thanks, David.
No worries. Thanks.
Thank you. See you then.
See you then.